I think that for me, I never really thought that it would die totally because it can't. Again, this is life or death. It's not a fad. It is life or death. And when things become so critical between life or death, it's almost like this is where it has to go.
Welcome to the 388th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. I recently had an opportunity to chat with Chris Nichols, an agricultural scientist who has played a key role in the current soil health movement. In early September, she was one of the presenters at a field day hosted by Tom and Alma Cotter in southern Minnesota. Tom is a member of the Land Stewardship Project's Soil Builders Network, and in recent years has become well known for utilizing diverse rotations, adapted rotational grazing, cover crops, and no-till to build soil health profitably. As I explained in Ear to the Ground 387, I first had an opportunity to interview Chris back in 2012 when she was involved with the highly influential Burley County Soil Health Team in North Dakota. That original conversation had a profound impact on how I viewed the potentially positive relationship between farming and a resilient soil biome. As she told me recently, the foundation of creating a regenerative form of agriculture is dumping some of the dogmatic thinking that has long plagued our approach to soil and soil management. In this episode, Chris and I continue our conversation about how far the soil health movement has come and where it's headed. One thing that's always fascinated me is the question of whether we can ever create a self-sufficient soil ecosystem that won't require human-made inputs to be productive and thrive. As you'll hear in this podcast, Chris grapples with that complicated question and makes it clear that there's a lot of potential for making use of soil's natural processes. She also talks about why our failure in this country to tap into soil's awesome potential for producing food is, as she puts it, truly terrifying. But before we get into all that, let's hear how the soil microbiologist makes a connection between Jeff Bezos's Amazon Prime delivery system and a crop field or pasture that's truly hitting its stride biologically.
What we're trying to do with the regenerative principles and with regenerative agriculture is really tap into this great diversity of microorganisms and macroorganisms that have develop the most efficient mechanisms for getting nutrients to the plant, getting water to the plant, supporting healthy plant growth, because the plants are the way in which those organisms get the food that they need to be able to grow. And so it's all about working within that cycle. And so they've developed this system that, you know, I say, you know, Jeff Bezos could only dream about. He's tried, you know, tried with drones and tried to do these things where you are more efficiently getting the delivery system of what gets ordered delivered to people as fast as possible. And you can pay for expedited shipping and you can do all of it. And you still can't get anywhere close to what the soil system does, because the plant will send out a signal any time of the day. In just a couple of seconds, it sends out a signal, carbon-based signal, that goes out through its roots that basically fires up the unit that can go out there. I think of it sometimes like a little army that you have all of these different right. units that have all of this specialty, you know. So the plant sends out a signal and says, I need copper this second. And the unit will get activated and that unit will do what it's supposed to do. And then not only will it get copper released from the soil, but you have things like mycorrhizal fungi that will deliver that copper inside the cell wall up against the cell membrane so efficiently. It's, as I said, like Amazon not just delivering it to your front door, but Amazon installing it or putting it in the fridge or freezer and then making dinner with it, or, you know, whatever the end task is that you're looking for, Amazon just does it all for you. We can't mimic that or do any better than what nature and the system is designed to do for us. And so what we're really wanting to do is really figure out how we can activate that system occurring much more frequently and at peak efficiencies and as needed, and doing this in an on-demand manner that, again, addresses the plant's needs on demand. A lot of our input systems are we put in the inputs that the plant needs for the whole growing season at one point in time, or maybe a few times throughout the growing season, but it's not an on-demand. Mm-hmm. When the plant has its greatest need is oftentimes when we can't apply the various nutrients. And so what ends up happening is when the plant has its biggest demand, we're at the point in time in which we're not addressing that deficiency. And at that time, usually in many soils, if we haven't had the biology active and we haven't had the factory working and we outsourced all of the jobs, there's no way in which they're going to be able to address those needs when the plant has the greatest level of demand.
So I got to ask this. The ultimate goal would be, the ultimate prize would be if we could make soil so self-sufficient that we wouldn't have to add outside inputs. Is that attainable, or is that just something we should always just reach for, but realizing maybe we're never going to quite get there? Is that, I mean, what do you think about that?
So it's a little bit of two schools of thought with that. And one is that in much of the soils that we have in North America, I mean, truly, they are some of the best soils on the planet. And part of this is because there hasn't been a whole lot of human beings messing with them for as long as many other areas of the world. We did have indigenous populations in North America and South America, but they weren't at the density and they didn't do the same level of messing with them as, you know, when we had populations coming from Africa and Asia and into Europe. And so we have really good soils that have a lot of the resources that would allow us to be able to be self-sufficient. Again, that's not the case for everywhere in the world, right. And it also isn't the case for all of North America. But I think there are some places in which that self-sufficiency could very well be achieved. The other issue with that, though, is there's self-sufficiency for the system to function in the way that it would naturally want to be able to function, and being able to obtain and do all of the practices and the cycles and the productivity that it naturally does. In food production, in agriculture, it truly is sort of an unnatural act. We're doing things in a natural world. We're utilizing natural ideas and natural concepts and natural thoughts, but we're doing this in an environment that is and doing this to achieve goals that are unnatural. We're asking the plants and animals to perform at levels that they wouldn't do. It is why we have done breeding and we have done selecting and we are looking at different varieties and those types of things, because we do need plants that are going to perform reproduction faster than normal. We are looking at animals that are going to do the same thing. And from that standpoint, are we going to be able to design a system that is completely self-sufficient and going to allow us to be able to feed that many people? I don't think so in its entirety. I think, again, like any system, what we're wanting to get out of the system, it's a trade-off. Everything is a trade-off analysis. And because we are pulling so much out of the system to be able to feed 10 billion people, I mean, I know that's not our population now, but it will be very soon. Right. So, you know, that's what we have to be thinking about, is we're pulling so much out of the system to do that. We have to provide energy back into that system. And again, going back to carbon, most of that energy and most of the way that would work would be in providing more carbon. And that's why focusing in on regenerating the soils and adding more carbon into the system. I think if we could get ourselves back to soils, most of the soils in the United States having organic matter percentages that would probably be in the teens, you know, at least close to 10, right. You know, it's going to be not single digits. We're looking at double digits here for, you know, the United States and for most of Canada, as well as, you know, parts of Mexico and into to Central and South America, and then, you know, be able to replicate that elsewhere in the world where we could get to those levels, having that amount of carbon in there, we probably could be self-sufficient as a whole to then be able to feed people. That takes, again, with the trade-off analysis, pulling stuff out, taking energy out of the system. Carbon is that energy form. Taking energy out of the system, we need to put energy back in. And that energy may have to come in the form of inputs that we're putting into it. And that's why I'm not going to say no inputs. We're just going to look at how we can reduce and manage that to not outsource the jobs of the microbial community, but at the same time, to keep the system functioning as close to self-sufficient as we possibly can.
Yeah. I think it's a lot like what regenerative ag is in. It's a continuum. You're working towards something, and there's going to be a lot of good that comes with that. But there's the realities of the situation that it is it's an exchange of energy, that kind of thing. One thing that I really appreciate is often when you hear, particularly a soil scientist or somebody who is an expert on soil health, present to a group of farmers, they talk about the importance of diversity. You know, we have seen how, and I know a lot of farmers talk about things like, I'd like to replicate the diversity that I've seen, say, in the traditional prairie type systems, you know, and people have really gotten the idea that this monocultural system is not going to get us anywhere near the soil health that we need. So diversity is very important. But a good point that you make is, boy, it doesn't matter if we preach diversity if there is not some kind of market for that diverse product, that diversity out there. Right now, our market system does not reward diversity. I think that's a really important point because it's almost like apple pie and puppies. Everybody's in favor of it, but it's got to pay.
Yeah, I think it is really important for us to be having these conversations about that. And having the conversations not in a way that's accusing anyone in particular. I mean, I think, you know, when I talk about it, sometimes farmers are like, well, but we're not bad if we can't do diversity. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that we need to have this conversation about how we can, across the whole entire agricultural industry, be able to get us to the point where we are having diversity in our agricultural production, as well as in the food that we're eating. We know that we have a lot of problems with our food and the nutritive quality and the nutrient density of our food, but it's not just that nutrient quality or nutritive density in one individual food item. It is having the diverse food that we need to be eating, introducing ourselves and working with a number of different things. We talk about oftentimes and you know, I'll talk with farmers and ranchers and say, you know, we have other plants that we could have part of our cover crop mixture, or you could do this and how you might be able to, you know, have plants growing for a longer period of time if we looked at some of these other plants. But we've locked ourselves in, even within cover crop mixtures, into a few of them. And there are so many thousands of different types of plants that we have out there, and so many thousands of different types of food that we have out there. What we've done is, again, for a lot of good reasons, I mean, again, because we're not all growing our own food. When we all are growing our own food, we could all grow whatever it is that we want and have a lot of that diversity. But when we have to have some sort of processing or some sort of flow where you are consolidating the types of food that are out there in order to be able to supply that, with not all of us being farmers or producing our own food. But that being said, we can go a lot further than where we are now. There is a lot of reasons why we got to this place where we have very little diversity in our diet. And recognizing that now, let's figure out how we can go beyond that. And at the same time, also engaging not just with farmers and ranchers, but also with food processors and other companies and policy and those types of things to recreate the infrastructure that is needed to help to support that level of diversity. We initially within agriculture had infrastructure that existed that helped to support the level of diversity that we've got, the way that we go about looking at different food. But what we did was we then as the industry grew, we started creating silos of you had various commodities that this is what you grow here and this is what you grow there. Mm-hmm. Again, there's very logical reasons for why we did that, but what it has done is it has very much narrowed what we're doing. And so my challenge to some of these large food companies that are out there, the Kellogg's, General Mills, Danone, all of these different types of food companies that we have out there, all across the spectra. I've talked with people, wine producers, various coffee producers. It's every commodity that we have out there. One of the questions that you have if you are a company that is looking at one particular type of commodity or, you know, only focusing certain times on certain commodities, what are you going to do about the rest of it? And for some of these companies now, because some of them, a lot of the large food companies are multinational and have absorbed so many other types of food production, they do have where, again, a company like Kellogg's or General Mills isn't just looking at grains. They have product lines that have meat in them and product lines that have produce and product line. I mean, and all of the those things mixed together in some of their product lines. So why should they only be reaching out and talking to wheat and oat producers? You should be wondering. And so, again, one of the questions that I will have when I engage with these companies is, what are you going to do about peas? Talked with a company about potato that produced potatoes, and I said, what are you going to do about barley? What are we going to do? We have to start challenging these food companies to not just go looking for single source commodities from the farmers and ranchers, but recognizing that if we want them to grow diverse crops, instead of we're going to go to this region and work with 10 farmers that are going to be our wheat producers, and we're going to go to this region and be talking to the ones that are going to grow our peas, and this one's going to grow our carrots, and doing all of that kind of stuff. It's now I have to talk to every one of them all at once and have my pea growers grow some wheat and my wheat growers grow some beans, and all of these things need to move around. I started a lot of the discussion today with some of the data that And I am very serious. It does really, really scare me. We are currently in the United States for the third, and we're kind of heading towards the fourth year in a row of being in a trade deficit when it comes to agricultural goods, which means that we import more food than we export. I say food because we actually import food and we export agricultural goods, which aren't really completely always the same thing.
Those are two different things.
They're two different things. To address that, when you look at the data of, again, what we're importing versus what we're exporting, it's not about bad trading partners. It's not about politics. It's not about all of those types of things between other countries. It's about the fact that we have gotten to the point in the United States that we're not growing food on much of the 900 million acres in agriculture that we have in this country, roughly about that amount. We don't grow food on most of it. As far as our population versus the amount of land that we have, you know, we've got a lot of advantages. You know, we're not a country that is measuring things in billions. We're a country that measures things in millions. 900 million acres seems like, you know, we could grow food, enough food on 900 million acres of agriculture. And we're not. Yeah. And that is truly, truly terrifying.
I remember when you flashed that chart showing the trade deficit, and I thought, what does this have to do with soil health? But I get it. You really connected that this, if we're not self-sufficient with our soil and with our farming system, I mean, it really is kind of a travesty that we are really still and can be an agrarian nation. We have such great resources. We have all these soils. And so it really does tie into that. It's this whole idea of a systems approach to our food system, as well as a systems approach to on the farm level too, I think. And this idea that if we expect farms to take a systems approach, then the food companies and our kind of our policies related to food, they need to take a systems approach as well, and a kind of a holistic approach as well.
Yeah, it has to go across the scale of the whole entire system. The food companies, government policies, everything has to be about taking this systems approach. And again, it can't be all on the farmers to do this. It's a tough enough job to be a farmer or rancher. You can't possibly want to think that this should be something else that they should have to take on. You know, if people do choose, there are a lot of farmers out there who are choosing direct marketing, a lot of people who are doing these things in trying to really address the food deserts that we have. But at the same time, what we're ending up with is a system that really isn't doing that at a large enough scale to make the difference. And again, too, like I said, this really does scare me. The only thing that has intrinsic value when we look at global economies, and we've had various economic collapses in the last several decades, the only thing that ever has had and ever will have intrinsic value is land, because that is where we grow food. And the difference between life and lifelessness is food. And part of the value of the United States as a country is the land that we have had to be able to grow food on. The same thing, you can take this up and down the scale, but for a farmer, their ability to borrow money, their ability to have value, how you value your farm is your land and the value of that land. And that value of that land has before was attached to our ability to grow food on that land. And when much of the commodities that we were growing have found their way out of or only indirectly in the food system, what has happened is, again, because we've removed the diversity, the value of that soil has declined. But it hasn't kept pace in the same way, because we look at yield and productivity and not at what you're growing and not at the quality of what you're growing and is that really food that you're growing, all of those things, which is where we started with agriculture. We're now at a place where that's not what we're doing. And again, looking at that trade deficit data, what scares me about that is the fact that who's going to come along and basically call in the debt? We have a debt that is our capacity to have that debt. You know, we can talk about national debt, and it isn't just it's a debt, not just an economic debt, but a debt to the world and to the people of the world. We have a debt. The only reason we were allowed to have that level of debt is because we had land to grow food. And if we're not growing food, just like for a farmer, if your land gets so bad that you can't get the productivity out of it, you're going to lose your land. Somebody's going to call in that debt. And that's where I'm scared with that data, is this is showing us that we can't make margin calls. Somebody calls in the debt, we're in a whole lot of trouble. And what is it that we're going to do? And so how can we shift that?
Yeah, that's a great point. I really like how you tied that in. I ran into you, like I said, over a dozen years ago when you were part of that Burley County Soil Health Team. I've been around long enough to see a lot of, I guess, movements or mini revolutions come and go in the sustainable ag or regenerative ag movement. There was the soil quality movement. There's been a lot of different things that have come and gone. The soil health movement really has legs, and it's I've seen it getting made part of policy. I've seen the NRCS kind of take it and run, and then I'm just seeing local farmers here. Beginning farmers are very excited about the soil health movement. Tom Cotter talks a lot about the community and networking and how important that's been. So I think now we're starting to see some food companies. We had a local food company here today that's buying some of Tom's and his neighbor's products. It's starting to get into the food movement a little bit. I guess overall, I kind of feel I would be interested in your perspective on, since you've kind of been part of this latest iteration of the soil health movement, where do you see it today? Or do you feel, I mean, we're not seeing nearly as many acres, for example, cover cropped as we should. We're not seeing nearly as many livestock out there being raised in a regenerative manner as we should. But, I mean, in general, how do you feel? Did you see it kind of, when you were first starting working with this, where did you think it was going to be going, and where has it gone for you? I mean, what's your perspective on it? I know that's an unfair question, but I just really interested because you have been kind of there from the beginning, I think, of this latest version of it.
So again, there's a little bit of two minds here. and I do think a lot about that. And part of me gets very frustrated because I'm like, again, on many levels, it was sort of started off, this is so simple. You should just do this. It makes economic sense. Everybody's happy. It's a win, 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 win. Right. All is good. We should be doing this. And as you realize, all of the issues that are in place, the biggest one being this infrastructure to really be able to market diverse products and utilize that in a different way. That frustration I've had to pull back on and say, you can't be, we've come a long ways and you can't be frustrated with it. And you're very right. In a lot of these movements, we get these buzzwords out there and then they become a buzzword and then they die. And some of that may be happening in some way within regenerative agriculture. But I think that for me, I never really thought that it would die totally because it can't. Again, this is life or death. This is not, it's not a fad. It's not, we're going to have Jordache jeans or Guess jeans or whatever. It's not something that makes us look cute. It is life or death. And when things become so critical between life or death, it's almost like this is where it has to go. I did say today, you know, I am an optimistic pessimist. I am optimistic about our potential and what it is that we can do and where we can go, because we can choose life and we will choose life because we have to. But my pessimistic side is it can take us a long time and a lot of agony and, you know, in some cases, some death along the way to get to this place where we choose life. And that's where my frustration comes in of, let's just choose life. Let's just go here, people. Why are we not already there? You know, again, why are we debating about how much regenerative or cover crop acreage we have? Or it should just all be there. Right. We should just all do this. Food should be food. It seems so simple on many levels. So again, the two minds of, I get frustrated because we're not there, but then I'm like, it can't stop. It won't stop because we have no other choice. We have no other choice. And really where a lot of this started was with producers. If you look at how this movement started, it started with a lot of producers that were on the very edge, mm-hmm. that they're in places where the margins are so incredibly tight. When I first was in North Dakota and working with these farmers and ranchers, and then I would go back and I would talk with my dad in southwestern Minnesota, and I'm like, if they can do that here, you have no excuse not to be doing it there. Why are you complaining when you get 20 rather than 25 inches of rain? Why are you looking to eastern Minnesota because they have some darker, richer soils and saying, yeah, I'm never going to be able to be where they are? So again, it was sort of this, what is it, necessity of invention? Oh. When things go bad, we need to do something different. Uh-huh. And in these areas where this movement started, in these areas where farmers were so close to the edge, margins were so slim, the innovations started. And I think when something starts where there's that level of desperation and need, it shows just how necessary it is to continue and maintain that going forward. And, you know, we're seeing where they started there because they needed something that was going to be more resilient in these very fragile systems, in these very fragile places. And now we're seeing that we need that resiliency across the whole entire planet, not just in these areas that are on the edge, but resiliency is a big part of the key. And that's, again, talking about, you know, the diverse income sources that, mm-hmm. that Tom was talking about today, having resilient, being able to dynamically respond to if it rains, if it doesn't rain, if it's cold, if it's hot, all of these things, creating that resiliency so that we can thrive and survive. Because again, it's choosing life or choosing death. No matter how I feel sometimes about human beings in the human race, I fell in love with a fungus when I was 19, and I'm a little bit nuts about microorganisms. So sometimes I see, you know, in the whole, like, people are, you know, which organisms are superior, and I'm like, hey, the ones that have been around for several hundred millennia and have developed these really efficient systems of how to work, human beings are sort of the beta test on what doesn't work out well. We're not, our infrastructure, our structure is not designed well. We don't interact with our environment well. We're really, you know, kind of not at the peak of what you would look at as a living organism. But despite that, we have a level of consciousness and interaction with the rest of the world that requires us to choose life. Necessity is the mother of invention. That's what I was trying to come up with. The phrase I was trying to... We are at the point where necessity is here. Mm-hmm. And the mother of invention is actually to go back to a system where we're looking at integrating and utilizing everything from microscopic to macroscopic.
Yeah, desperation can breed some real ingenuity and some real innovation. But also, maybe we don't have a choice other than to choose that path if we're going to exist in the future. But also, I like this idea of choice that I remember that message kind of came out in Burley County, where one of the mantras was, we don't have to accept a degraded resource. Because that be, it's like, well, this is the way it is. The soil's only going to go in one direction, which is less organic matter, less of the soil. We're just going to have to just keep applying inputs to keep it going. You touched on it a little bit today because you talked about we can change our destiny or what seems to be our destiny. I think that's a really important message that we don't have to accept a certain path just because maybe that's the way things look. That looks like that's a trajectory. We can change that trajectory.
Yeah, I think that that's very true. And, you know, kind of going back to where we started this conversation of dogma.
Yeah.
Dogma has put us in this place of this is the only thing. And we got ourselves sort of in that box of saying, we're stuck here, you know, and somebody come save us. It's, you know, that old story about, you know, the man who was in a flood and he got to heaven and he asked St. Peter, you know, why didn't you help me? And, you know, he was like, well, I sent you notification that it was going to happen, and I sent you a rowboat, and I sent you a helicopter, and I sent you, and you didn't choose to save yourself. I can't do all of, you know, you can lead a horse to water and you can't make it drink. All of those things that we say are very true in this thing. And if we put ourselves in the box that dogma has told us that we should be in, that is only going to lead us to a path that is not sustainable. It's not. And again, you know, we went away from talking about sustainable because sustain degradation. Is that what we're going to do?
Right.
Are we going to sustain bad? No. We're going to regenerate. We're going to reinvigorate. We're going to innovate. And all of those things, all of those positive things, I think are important to the way that we think as humans and important to getting us happy, allowing us to be happy and excited and invigorated about what we're doing. And, you know, I think that we just need to be, again, choosing life, focusing on the options and opportunities. That's why I talk about, you know, again, carrots and sticks. And I'm like, I don't want to talk about the sticks. The carrots are all of these options and opportunities. It's your choice. You have the ability to choose all of these paths, and you can keep choosing and innovating and moving around however it works for you. There are options and opportunities, and when we put ourselves in a box, there are no options and opportunities. If we say we cannot change organic matter percentages in your lifetime, there's no option or opportunity to do anything. Why would I do anything? Why would I invest in trying to regenerate the soil if I can't do it? Why do I even try? I really don't like dogma that limits us. And oftentimes that's where dogma has come, is limitations and controls in trying to channel behavior in one way or another. We're fun as organisms. Like I said, I love fungi more than us, but we're kind of fun, and it'll be interesting to see how we go about doing this. And we have a lot of opportunities and a lot of options in front of us.
A link to the first part of my interview with Chris Nichols is available on the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 388 at landstewardshipproject.org. On that page, you'll also find a podcast interview I did with Tom Cotter, as well as one I did with Chris Nichols and Jay Fear way back in 2012. We've also provided a link to the original series of articles I did on the Burley County Soil Health Team. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendale, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.